This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Yesterday, North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper announced plans to sue the Tennessee Valley Authority if it doesn't cut down on emissions from its power plants. The TVA has 9 coal-fired power plants in Tennessee, Alabama, and Kentucky. And the North Carolina Attorney General says emissions from those plants are drifting across state lines and contributing to air pollution here in North Carolina. Now, this is not the first time that the state's Attorney General has pinned the blame for North Carolina's air pollution problem on other states. Back in March, North Carolina became the first southern state to petition the Environmental Protection Agency to force neighboring states to reduce their emissions. Joining us right now to talk about yesterday's announcement about the coming lawsuit and air pollution in North Carolina is Cecil Bothwell, who's a reporter for the Asheville Mountain Express. Hi there, Cecil.
Hello. Glad to be here today.
Hi. Welcome back. Well, how much can North Carolina blame other states for the air pollution problem here?
Western North Carolina in particular can definitely blame other states. We only have one coal-fired plant at this end of the state, and much of the pollution from that would then blow on east from here. In fact, a study that was done by the Southern Appalachian Mountain Initiative and released in 2002, a multi-year study, showed that the majority of pollution in western North Carolina comes from Tennessee, Georgia, and South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. So this is not the first time, as we say, that Roy Cooper, North Carolina's attorney general, has tried to force other states to comply with emission standards here.
No, in March, he wrote a letter to the TVA, and actually 2 years earlier, he'd written to the TVA requesting information about their emissions with an eye toward pushing them to get cleaner.
And it's not working yet?
Not yet, as far as we can tell.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that lawsuits such as this are allowed under the Federal Clean Air Act, and states in the Northeast did this rather successfully in the 1990s, suing states to the west, saying that a lot of the pollutants were blowing into the northeastern part of the U.S. Is it realistic to expect that North Carolina may succeed with, you know, just one state across the border?
Apparently, there's a good chance for success if the federal law doesn't change. And part of setting ourselves up for making that kind of a case was to clean up our own plants. Once we'd cleaned up our own plants with what's called the Clean Smokestacks Act, it's actually the Improved Air Quality Electric Utilities legislation. Once we'd cleaned our own act up, we were in a position to try to press states upwind of us to also comply with the Clean Air Act.
So we have now the Clean Smokestacks Act. That's something within North Carolina's borders. It's totally state. It's the state of North Carolina saying,
right,
we've got to clean up our own backyard first. And that requires 14 coal-fired power plants in North Carolina to reduce their emissions. And have they indeed done that?
They've started to. And on top of what they've started to do, it also prevented them from trading their pollution credits to plants upwind of us. Under the pollution credit system, different plants around the country can trade their emissions credits. So if you take your plant to where it's cleaner than you're required to be, you're given credits for the pollution you didn't create, and you can sell that to a plant somewhere else that's dirtier than it ought to be. It was considered a free market way of reducing pollution overall, but our Clean Smokestacks legislation prevented utilities here from selling their credits to people upwind of us. Mm-hmm. Therefore, at least the credits here couldn't be used to dirty our air.
Right. Now, the Attorney General is accusing the Tennessee Valley Authority, which, as we've mentioned, is not just in Tennessee, but also in Alabama and in Kentucky, of not even meeting the federal Clean Air Act regulations, which aren't as tough as North Carolina's.
Right.
And it was all in the news in a year or two ago that President Bush wanted to make some changes in that, but that has not yet happened. In other words, some would say reduce the impact of the Clean Air Act, make it easier to pollute.
Right. What he'd like to do is change the law, which right now requires that if there's an increase in capacity or a substantial change to a plant, that it has to meet the new air quality regulations. And he wants to change that so they can still grandfather in the older regulations and therefore continue to pollute at an older rate instead of complying with the newer laws. Mm-hmm. And if that were the case, if that becomes the law, apparently North Carolina wouldn't have much of a case. against the TVA.
Right. So was this a matter of, is there some sense that Roy Cooper was trying to act quickly while there was still the Federal Clean Air
Act?
That's
the way it looks. Yeah. And in the meantime, John Shipp, who's Vice President of Environmental Policy and Planning for the TVA, said that they're in the middle of an improvement program and that they will meet the rules.
Yeah. So if North Carolina were to win a lawsuit, what does it get? Does it get money? Does it get the TVA to really crack down on itself and reduce?
I gather the real goal is to get them to crack down rather than a monetary settlement.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're in Asheville, close to the Tennessee border, and air pollution has been a real issue in your area for some time. How bad is the air quality there?
Well, in the summer, it can be pretty bad. We have a situation here in Asheville particularly where we're ringed by mountains to the east of us. It sets up a condition that is ripe for a thermal inversion pattern in which when certain temperature situations occur in the summer, it sort of puts a cap above the mountains that keeps the pollution here in Asheville. And there are frequent warnings in the summertime about not exercising outdoors, especially don't climb the peaks. And, of course, for a place that's dependent on tourism and on people who want to go up in the mountains, that's not very good advertising.
Yeah. You're not going for those mountaineers.
No. Local health authorities here have said that we're really in a health crisis situation in regard to asthma, with the increase in asthma here. And that's so ironic because in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, people afflicted with tuberculosis used to come here because of the clean air. And now people with severe asthma actually move away from Asheville to get away from the dirty air.
Now, of course, the TVA might say, well, all of Asheville's pollution problems can't be laid at our doorstep. That, you know, Asheville's a city. It may well be contributing to its own problems.
That's true. We certainly do have traffic, although nothing like a really big city. But according to the studies that have been done, a great deal of it is coming from those plants. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's easier to control in some ways because you can scrub plants easier than you can control vehicles, which are controlled by federal regulations, which, of course, have been weakened over the years as well.
Right. The amount of mileage and the amount
right.
of emissions that come from cars.
Right.
So have you started doing emissions testing in the Asheville area?
Just this year. Yeah. It's finally been added to our vehicle inspections.
Yeah. How is that going over with people?
I've heard some grumbling, but the testing stations all have the equipment, and it's moving forward.
Yeah. So what other efforts are underway at the local level in Asheville and in Western North Carolina to get a grip on this? Because I understand that the Great Smoky National Mountains, for the first time in the past couple of years, was not attaining the kind of air quality that the EPA says a place is ought to attain.
Right. It's the most polluted national park at this point, and it's really shocking if you look at photographs from the 1950s and see how clear the views were, and then compare it to the same photos taken today. The visibility has been reduced 80% in the summer from 50 years ago. There are serious efforts underway here to control local pollution. One effort that's gaining ground here is to move to a better transit system to discourage commuters from using cars. Recently, there was a report by the transportation director from Chapel Hill where they've gone to a fare-free transit system. And one of our city council members here is pushing for a 2-year program here to experiment with fare-free transit to see if we can reduce the commuter traffic here.
On the grounds, it would be an incentive for people to do that if they didn't have to pay to go on.
Apparently, yeah. It's been quite successful in Chapel Hill, Carrboro. Mm-hmm. At least that's what we hear out here. And we have parking problems as well as traffic problems, which could perhaps be ameliorated with that kind of a system.
Right. Now, I understand EPA estimates that pollution causes more than 25,000 asthma attacks across North Carolina every year. And that's due largely to the pollution that comes from the power plants and cars. Is there a possibility of any tobacco-like class action suit?
I haven't heard of that out here, but it seems entirely possible insofar as it affects everyone. And EPA has said that ground-level ozone can worsen not only asthma but bronchitis and emphysema. So there's all those combined health problems, which of course run up health care costs in addition to hurting people, you know, physically.
But of course, what we have right now is the Attorney General from North Carolina saying that he's about to sue the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, over the pollution that comes over. How do you think this will play out, politically speaking, given, you know, the Bush administration has tried to scale back the Federal Clean Air Act that I believe actually allows such lawsuits to happen?
Right. That's difficult to say. It seems that they still don't have a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. And although they extended the Republican hold on the Congress by a few seats, it hasn't. They still probably don't have enough strength to push that one through. That'd be my guess, because clean air affects so many people, and moderate Republicans at least seem to be interested in clean air as well. So I think they have a tough road to hoe to get that the Clear Skies Initiative pushed through.
That would be the president's plan, his
right.
version of a Clean Air Act.
Right.
Well, Cecil Bothwell, thank you for being with us once again.
I'm happy to be here.
Breathe well.
Okay. Thank
Cecil
you.
Bye-bye. Bothwell is a reporter for the Asheville Mountain Express. Just ahead, we'll have a talk with author Warren St. John about fan mania. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. New York Times reporter Warren St. John once spent 3 hours listening to an Alabama Crimson Tide game on the telephone. Now, he wasn't a reporter then. He was and remains a fan. And that's not the worst of it. He has wept when the Crimson Tide has lost games. He has refused to wear red, the team colors, to games because of superstition. Warren St. John considers himself a hardcore fan of Alabama football, but not quite as serious, perhaps, as the fans he profiles in his new book. The book is called Rammer Jammer, Yellow Hammer, A Journey into the Heart of Fan Mania. And for the book, Warren St. John spent a season in an RV trailing the most serious fans of the Crimson Tide. And Warren St. John joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. Hearing myself described that way makes me a little scared.
Of what? Of yourself?
Of myself, yeah.
Well, you
looking for the men in white coats at any moment.
Well, that's what you got into here, because you grew up as an Alabama fan. You grew up in Alabama, and you grew up as an Alabama football fan, and you never quite questioned it until you got to college. Is that right?
That's right. Well, I grew up in Birmingham and went to college at Columbia, New York City, and it was this sort of weird emotional whiplash where I went from, you know, the land of championships and always winning to what was the longest losing streak in the history of college football when I got to Columbia. And I think it was 44 games without even a tie. And that had an effect of sort of making me wake up and realize, you know, there's another side to this experience that I wasn't aware of. And it's not pretty.
Well, you have this moment of recognition that you go to this game where it will be decided if Columbia is the losingest team in history. And
right.
And your classmates from Columbia are rooting for the other team because they want the record. And you find yourself actually rooting for Columbia because...
Well, I guess they felt after 4 years of not winning anything, they wanted at least the title of the worst. And so it was the Columbia-Princeton game in 1987, I believe. And the Columbia students cheered every time Princeton scored a touchdown. They actually, when Columbia lost, they tried to tear down the goalpost in celebration. And I was just utterly distraught because my conditioning growing up didn't find any room to accommodate losing as a kind of entertaining prospect.
Mm-hmm. And you have there's just one other comment in your book about how you got to Columbia and you decorated the wall of your dorm with a photo of you and Bear Bryant.
Yeah, that's right.
The legendary coach of Alabama.
Yes, and it was a great shock to me to learn at 17 years old that there were people who didn't know who this was. This is a man whose face is in every barbecue joint in Alabama. He's certainly an icon all over the Southeast, and I got to Columbia and realized there were people who confused this man. They just assumed he was my grandfather,
right.
And I set them straight.
That's right. Well, Warren St. John, I was wondering if you might read us the opening paragraph of your book. I think sets out what you were after here, as a lifelong Alabama fan, but also as a reporter trying to understand what it is that makes us all tick.
Sure, and I should say that, you know, the goal going in was to understand the phenomenon of fandom, which ultimately is, I think, the same across, you know, Little League baseball fans and college football fans and Brazilian soccer fans all really go through something emotionally very similar. And so I picked one pod of people that I happen to know to try to get at some of that bigger stuff, and that's what I write about in this paragraph. At some point in the life of every sports fan, there comes a moment of reckoning. It may happen when your team wins on a last-second field goal or three-point basket, and you suddenly find yourself clenched in a loving embrace with a large, hairy man you've never met and with whom you have nothing in common except allegiance to the same team. Or it may come in the long, hormonally depleted days after a loss, when you're felled by a sensation oddly similar to the one you felt when you first experienced the death of a pet. In such moment, even the fan who rigorously avoids anything approaching self-awareness is sometimes forced to confront a version of the question others, spouses, friends, children, and colleagues, have asked for years. Why do I care? In very general terms, that's what this book is about, the human obsession with contests.
Warren St. John from his new book, which is Rammer Jammer Yellowhammer, A Journey into the Heart of Fan Mania. For those of us here in North Carolina, is that part of the song for Alabama?
It's just a line from it's a random cheer, and I chose it as a title because it sort of onomatopoetically captured the insanity of the enthusiasm and the unruliness of the world that I was writing about.
Mm-hmm. So what you did was you'd been going to these games or following these games for years, but you just decided that one way to capture this would be to hit the road, sort of hit the road. You weren't going to go far, but you were going to get in an RV. Which so many people do to go to games now.
Right. I figured if I wanted to understand what fandom was all about, the best way to get at that would be to immerse myself in a culture that is totally consumed. And I knew from growing up in Alabama that there is this convoy of RVs that goes to every University of Alabama football game, anywhere from 300 to 500 of these things. They show up on Wednesday night or Thursday morning for Saturday's game, and then on Sunday morning they take off to the next place. It may be Gainesville or Oxford or, in one case, UCLA. About 100 RVs drove from Alabama to Los Angeles. And usually for a couple of days they'll park their RVs and then they'll leave to take care of their life just long enough to get back to the stadium. And so I decided to join up with this crowd. And the first way I did it was by putting posts on internet fan sites essentially begging to get invited aboard strangers' RVs. And not surprisingly, there weren't a lot of people who were keen to have someone get on their RV and write down everything they said for a long weekend.
That idea of hugging a total stranger only goes so far.
Exactly. Right? It takes a certain kind of spark to get you in that mood, and it doesn't usually come on Wednesday or Thursday.
Okay. Well, and the RV was a rather new innovation. It was a new twist. Years and years ago, people didn't drive RVs from game to game or hang out outside the stadiums that way.
That's right. And I think, and I talk about this in the book, that in a way, technology and modernity has sort of changed the experience of being a fan. It used to be in the old days, you just showed up on Saturday for a three-hour game, and then you basically left, and that was that. Now, because of RVs, people can get to the stadium and sort of live the fan experience for days at a time. Because of the internet, fans are constantly on fan bulletin boards and talk radio, and there's this sort of opportunity to be completely immersed in the fan experience if you have the aptitude for it, and it turns out that a lot of people do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We are talking with Warren St. John. His new book is Rammer Jammer Yellowhammer, A Journey into the Heart of Fan Mania. And we're joined now by Arnie Schechter, who is a fan of Duke basketball. He's also been a freelance sports writer and contributor to the fan website DukeBasketballReport.com. Welcome, Arnie Schechter.
Thank you.
So you consider yourself a serious fan of Duke basketball, but you haven't always been. And unlike Warren St. John, who grew up an Alabama fan and remains one, your allegiance was somewhere else.
I have to admit, I hate this is going out on the public airways, but I grew up as a North Carolina fan growing up in Kinston. And the happiest moment of the first, I'd say, 17 years of my life was when North Carolina won the national championship in 1957. that changed immediately when I got to Duke. The first home game was against Michigan, a number one ranked team with Cassie Russell. Duke eventually lost the game, but late in the game, Duke tied the score. And you literally could not hear yourself scream. That's how loud it was in the building. Years later, I became a sports writer. I ran into Jack Maron, who was on that team, and I asked him what it was like when that happened. And he said, Arnie, it was like being inside a jet engine that had been turned on. He said, we went to the bench, and the coach was trying to tell us trying to give us instructions, tell us what to do, and we just had our palms in the air. We couldn't hear a single word. Mm-hmm. And every freshman that walked out of there was that night was a Duke fan after that.
Now, Warren St. John, what do you think about that idea of changing allegiances that way?
Well, that's certainly unusual, and I think that's one of the things that I found is that I sort of liken fandom to sort of languages, in that when you're young, we have this incredible capacity to learn languages. It's as though our brains are searching for social connections, and so we can pick up new ways of communicating and bonding with other people. And I find that as people get older, the opportunities to learn a new language, pick up a new team, they sort of diminish, because it turns out you don't really need that so much as you're older. But when you're young, you're desperate for any kind of sense of belonging to something broader. So it's unusual to find people who switch teams, but of course it can happen. But those who pick it up at a very young age rarely shake it off.
Well, you write about somebody in your book. This was a man who had, over the course of 40 years, had been to 500 Alabama games.
That's right, yes.
But he had never attended Alabama. And he was what he described as a true fan, because he did this by choice.
That, I always thought this was very interesting, because a lot of the alumni of the school sort of looked down in their way on the RVers. Almost none of the RVers that I followed actually attended the University of Alabama. I'd say 90 to 95% are so-called sidewalk alumni. That's what the actual alumni call them, in a slightly derogatory sort of way. But this man said to me, well, you know, I think I'm a pure fan, because I had all the teams out there in the world to pick, and I chose this one. These other folks, they went to the school, they had to pull for it, so they're not as dedicated as I am.
Right. We are talking about sports fandom and the lengths to which people will go to be fans of their teams. In the case of Alabama, you had people that were following the team around in RVs. Now, at Duke, Arnie Schechter, of course, there's the tent cities that set up way in advance of getting tickets to the games at Cameron. And are there any other manifestations of this?
Well, I'd say that the internet, because so many Duke alumni are scattered around the world. The internet has become the community for Duke basketball, and specifically the Duke basketball report, started by two fans plus another computer guy that makes it all work. And the site is not only the most visited college sports site in the world, it's one of the most visited sports sites in the world. They've had on the front page alone almost 150 million hits. And I moved back to – actually, I feel your pain about Columbia, by the way. I did my MBA there. I still root for them, though it's hopeless.
Do you root for them to lose or to win?
I root for them to win. I wouldn't
ask, right?
I wouldn't do that, but at any rate, the internet has just I've made so many friends through this. I became friendly with the two folks who started the DBR, we call it, to shorten the name. And I've having been a sports writer, and I follow recruiting very closely, and a lot of people call me or email me for recruiting news. Since I came back to North Carolina in the mid-'80s, almost my entire circle of friends has come about meeting folks at pickup games, halftime of games. We have a circle of a group that of about 40 folks that email each other. And this has stretched at times as far as London or Tokyo. And people come to the area, go out and have dinner with them, and it's really my whole social circle is around Duke basketball.
Well, I wonder about this, and maybe Warren, you can describe this for us as well. Does that ferocity of being a fan, does it almost get more intense the farther away you may get from the school, because it's your link to the tribe, so to speak?
Well, I think that's definitely the – I'm sure that's the case. And I think that fundamentally what is going on here is that fandom is a sort of it's impossible to separate the idea of fandom from a sort of social construct. It's not just the players on the field and the rules of the game and what the ball does, but it's the sense of camaraderie that one gets from fellow fans. And I talk a bit in my book about sort of the evolutionary psychologist view of why this might be. And if you think about it, eons ago, when we weren't as evolved as we are now, we learned that we really needed allies to survive. We didn't do well on our own. And so it would make sense that we evolved to put a high premium on making connections with other people instantly and quickly assessing friend from foe, and also understanding that if someone out there fighting on our behalf loses, that's very bad for us. And if they win, that literally means or meant a long time ago that we survive. And I think sports kind of taps into this ancient encoded desire we have and need, in fact, to connect with other people in order to survive. And of course, we don't actually survive more just because our team wins, but our brains, in a way, don't know the difference. And I think that's what's so fascinating about sports.
You say that, you know, we have evolved, but there are folks that you write about in the book that one might question that. there are a couple of them, and actually two of these stories have to do with weddings and marriages. You talk about having gone back to Alabama and seeing this thing on this news report on TV.
That's right. This is sort of the inspiration for the book in a way. And this is a couple named Freeman and Betty Reese from Birmingham, Alabama. I was watching local TV. They were doing a sort of slice of life from the stadium parking lot kind of story. And they interviewed this couple and said, well, what have you given up anything particular to follow the team? And this man got a sort of guilty expression on his face. And he said, well, we skipped our daughter's wedding to go to the Alabama-Tennessee game. And I tracked this man down years later. I never forgot this story. And in fact, he wasn't hard to find because everyone in Alabama held him in incredibly high esteem.
Because of this?
Because he had made such a sacrifice for the team. But I asked him why he did it. And he got a sort of, this expression I'll never forget, it was a sort of blank, sort of a befuddlement but curiosity, as if I'd ask a question he'd never pondered before in his life. And he said, I guess I just like football. And that seemed to be a very unsatisfying explanation. And that's when I realized, you know, maybe there's some use in going out and trying to understand this a little bit better than that. And that was the goal of the book.
But you write further that when you told that story to people that you got two responses. There were those of us who just rolled our eyes at the idea of somebody that misses this incredibly important milestone in their daughter's life. Her wedding. They did make it for the reception, I understand.
They made the reception.
Well, that
right
was kind
after,
of them. Yes. Oh, but you have those people who would hear that story and roll their eyes, but then you ran into other people whose response was...
They would ask, well, what was the daughter doing getting married on that day? And this was always, to me, a kind of litmus test question for whether someone understood the fan mind or not. I found fans would almost always say, well, that's a terrible day to get married. And why would you do that to your parents? Put them in a terrible position where they have to choose something like this?
Between you or was it the Alabama-Tennessee game? Right?
Exactly. And I'm sure, not knowing too much about the individual psychology of the family, I'm sure there was a bit of a challenge there on the daughter's part, and she unfortunately got her answer.
Right, right. Now, Arnie Schechter, have you run into anything to that degree among Duke fans?
Yes. I'm here to admit that I have. Just a couple of examples. I have one friend and who applied for the open job of athletic director last time the job was open at Duke and showed up in the office of the vice president of the university demanding an interview. And his qualification for the job, he felt, was that he loved Duke so much that he would do a great job. I have there's Herb Neubauer, who's well known around here as the crazy towel guy, waves his towel at the Duke games. Herb, I believe, sold his company when he was in his 40s and does absolutely nothing but follow all Duke sports.
I mean, literally, gets on the road. And
that's what he does. When Duke won their first national championship at the team banquet, which is attended by many of the supporters and fans, Herb arrived in a long stretch limo, got out in a tuxedo, had his Duke blue carnation in his lapel, and a glass of champagne in his hand. It was a great moment. And if you can bear with one other story, which I love, the kind of the touchstone in the history of Duke basketball was the Duke-Kentucky game in 1992 when double overtime, of course, Christian Laettner made a shot with 2 seconds left to win. And another friend of mine is a wealthy attorney, lives in Phoenix. He built a huge house. He built a movie screening room, and the walls of the screening room were set about 70 by 12 feet. He had an artist live in his home for 1 year to paint the Laettner shot. It was almost life-size in that 70 feet long was about the distance that Grant Hill threw the ball to Christian Laettner.
So I think out there we might have people who say, my God, why would you do that? And others who say, makes perfect sense,
absolutely.
Right? What kind of frame do you put
that
on
big,
it?
I would, sure.
We are talking about fandom today. With us are Arnie Schechter, a fan of Duke basketball, former sports writer, and Warren St. John, author of Rammer Jammer Yellow Hammer, A Journey into the Heart of Fan Mania. We'll have more of our conversation just ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava. Today we're talking about sports fans and fan mania, that force that turns otherwise seemingly sane people into face-painting, field-wrecking sports fanatics. We are joined by Warren St. John. He grew up a fan of Alabama football, spent a season following an RV caravan of Crimson Tide fans, and he's written a book about the experience. It's called Rammer Jammer Yellow Hammer, A Journey into the Heart of Fan Mania. Also with us is a fan of the Blue Devils, sports writer and Duke basketball fan, Arnie Schechter. Well, Warren St. John, we talk about those people that take down the goalposts at the end of games. From your travels with the Alabama fans, common occurrence? Is that a reputation that's earned? Or
Tearing down goalposts specifically?
Yeah, and that kind of, you know, running onto the field, tearing things up.
Well, it's interesting. I think there are a lot of misperceptions of fans that have been sort of debunked by this sort of small but interesting group of social psychologists who took some of these classic beliefs people have about fans and said, well, let's just test them and see if they're true. Is it, you know, there's a perception that fans are sort of couch potatoes who sit around and watch things on TV and they must be lazier than everyone else. And these sociologists did surveys and found that, in fact, hardcore sports fans are more likely than non-fans to be athletically active, which may be a little surprising, but if you think about it, it makes sense. If you hold an athlete in high regard, you're going to be probably more predisposed to go out and run that extra mile just to be like him. But what's really interesting is that fans seem to suffer depression at lower rates than the rest of the population and seem to have higher self-esteem, according to a couple of studies that have been done, mostly actually around college basketball fans. And I think part of that is because we know that if you have a lot of friends, if you feel that you're part of something, we feel better about ourselves. And self-esteem really depends on our recognition and affirmation by other people. So if you can just put on a blue shirt and get high fives from strangers all over the place, it could have the effect of making you feel a little bit better about yourself. And I think certainly the RV crowd that I followed was sort of bizarrely, almost pathologically happy, except, of course, after a loss. But even those, they seem to get over pretty quickly. And I think that's because they felt like they were part of something that enhanced them.
But what if you were, and these are folks who are following the Crimson Tide, a very good football team.
Sure.
In most years.
Well, not all, but yes.
In most years. But what about those who are like fans of like the Red Sox, who finally, pails of ink that were spilled writing about how after they won the World Series, they didn't quite know what to do with themselves.
Exactly. Because they'd been sort of the victims of sport for so long. Now they had to re-identify themselves somehow. I think people come back to teams that lose really because it's like the way people keep putting coins into slot machines when they know they're going to lose their money. If you have experienced one jackpot, it's such a powerful feeling. It's such an ecstatic, bizarrely pleasurable feeling that you will endure the threat of losing, in the case of gamblers, a lot of money, and in the case of sports fans, a lot of time, energy, and emotional output, just in the hope that you're going to get that big win. Mm-hmm. And I think that drives drives the mentality behind a lot of obsessive fans in particular.
But of course, in the case of Boston, it was your grandfather hitting the jackpot.
Exactly. But even along the way, there were those moments where they tasted what it might be like. Yeah. You know, it's like the jackpot, the three wheels rolling, the first two come up, you know, as jackpots, and then you see you just missed by one. So you're going to put that coin in again. Mm-hmm.
We are joined now by Thad Williamson, who is now a lecturer in social studies at Harvard, but he grew up in Chapel Hill, and he was then a fan of Carolina. He's author of the book More Than a Game, Why North Carolina Basketball Means So Much to So Many. Welcome, Thad Williamson.
Thank you.
Hi. Well, and you're still a Carolina fan?
Absolutely.
Because Harvard doesn't really have a basketball team worth talking about.
Is that... No, and I would root for Brown anyway, because that's where I went undergraduate.
Okay. Well, you interviewed 600 fans of Carolina basketball. You wanted to know whether being sports fans made them less likely to be involved in other activities. And what we've heard what Warren St. John is talking about here. Did you find similar things?
A slightly more complicated story. I mean, I think Warren is definitely right that the sociological and psychological literature indicates there's a positive correlation between being a fan and self-esteem, and people attract fans over the course of a whole season. And what I did is I did basically two tracks. One is I did some sociological research with, you know, thousands of Americans in general, and then second looked at 600 Carolina fans in particular, and basically the story is that being an athlete or being involved, you know, in sports as a participant is a positive, and being a moderate sports fan, especially going to games a lot, is also a positive in terms of, you know, being involved in volunteer activities, being involved in church, being involved in political activities, and so forth. Being a hardcore sports fan, there seems to be more of a displacement going on, but that's like at the very highest or fanatic level. So you can imagine, if you're spending your whole life, following a team around in the RV, you probably don't have as much time, you know, for the PTA. And so there's some evidence about that, but I don't think the effect is overwhelming. And I think that I found many examples among Carolina fans, among people who were activists and are very community-minded people and are also our sports fans.
Is there anything there about economic levels? Because in order to get a ticket to see Carolina, I mean, sometimes it's tough to come by tickets to a lot of the college basketball games in the Triangle. So would you not already be a person that might have, you know, you're doing okay in life, and so you have some connection to your community too?
Yeah, well, I think so. I mean, in sort of the bigger surveys, you can control for that and still isolate these effects. But I do think it's true that someone who has enough money to buy a ticket also probably is, you know, better educated and more likely to be tapped in the community in other ways as well.
But this correlation, though, that you found where people who went to games and followed the team have some investment in their community and be active, that ended when it came to being a TV watching fan, a fan who caught the games on TV.
Yeah, I found much different effects between going to a game and watching one on TV. But basically, in general, watching TV is bad for a lot of things in terms of being involved in community affairs, trusting other people, being happy. And just TV watching in general is a bad thing. And to the extent that sports, you know, causes people to watch the TV, it can be a negative that way. So I would really like to see is, you know, more people going out and supporting local teams, even at the high school level or at the smaller scale level, as opposed to spending all their time, you know, watching the NFL or sort of, you know, these mass market teams. I think that provides a much more tangible connection to communities and other people.
I wonder, Arnie Schechter, is it that the college teams, college sports in the Triangle area in North Carolina are very, very popular? And as opposed to in other parts of the country where you might have the professional teams, you know, the professional basketball team, et cetera. Is there more of that connection here that people get behind it?
I think that I think the local rivalry here is particularly pointed for a few reasons. One is the proximity of the schools. Duke and Carolina campuses have seen different numbers. They're basically 8 miles apart. You're interacting with other fans all the time. there are incredibly strong emotions. When I was living in Raleigh and looking for a lot in Chapel Hill, I couldn't believe that when the real estate agent found out that I was a Duke fan, he said, "Why do you want to live here?" And I said, "Well, you know, there are 4,000 Duke alumni in Orange County." And he said, "There are that many of you illegitimate children living here?" And he was trying to sell me a lot. So I think the proximity of the schools, each of the three schools has a great tradition. They have their pantheon of basketball gods. They've each won multiple national championships. And I'm not a sociologist, but I think there is some element of that here, where you have an excellent public university, an elite private university, and a technical and agriculture and engineering university with alumni from different places with different career goals. And I do think the proximity is a lot of it. The other thing, as we were talking about the internet before, there is a tremendous amount of acrimony. I don't know if you've ever been on a sports message board, but some of them are well moderated, others are not. But you can find, just hateful messages, obscenity, threats of violence. I don't think the internet in that way has been good for sports fans. It has brought certain communities together. DevilsBeat.com, Duke Basketball Report, in other ways, it's caused tremendous rifts and ill feelings between fans.
Warren St. John, does that spill out into the stands? Has there been a change in the attitude? Have rival teams' fans become more vociferous and
I don't.
Do they flame out in person as they might on?
I don't think they do. It's interesting. I've always been amazed that in the United States there's so little fan violence. Usually, the kind of riots that occur in the United States are sort of victory celebrations that get out of control. A lot mm-hmm. of people probably had a lot to drink, and I think alcohol becomes the major factor there. We don't have the kind of rival fan violence that English soccer has had for so long. And I think there's this kind of incredible capacity to self-police among fans. I know that in the stands, when violence breaks out, people tend to step back if there's a fist fight. And then when the police come and take the person away, usually the section claps and applauds. And I think fans, and even in their own clumsy way, internet bulletin boards kind of police themselves, where you'll get these random ruptures of insanity, and then the cooler voices prevail and a consensus is reached, and that happens in real time in the stands as well.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about one other aspect of fans, and especially for college teams, it seems perhaps more so than for professional teams, and that is where people talk about my coach. And these are people who never suited up to play on the field. You know, you had it with Bear Bryant in Alabama, Warren St. John. You have it with Mike Krzyzewski, Arnie Schechter, and Thad Williamson, your guy, Dean Smith, for years and years, correct?
That's right.
Yeah. Why is it you think that we think of them as our coach? I mean, why would fans, think that way about them?
Well, I think one thing about college sports in general is that for adults, it's a lot easier to identify with a coach than with the players, and a lot of times the players are kind of labeled, as quote kids, and not really seen as fully rational people, and almost treated like commodities. Whereas like the coach is someone like them, so I think that's a sort of natural tendency in college sports. But I think with all three of those figures, there's a distinctive persona there that builds up over years, and people. I grew up in Chapel Hill. Everything Dean Smith said in the Chapel newspaper, I read it, absorbed it. It was, deeply embedded in my brain. I could recall it 10 years later. And I know Alabama fans feel the same way about Bear Bryant. And so I think, when you get someone in the same place for a long time and they're the one common link that binds it together, it is natural to find that kind of allegiance. And in the Carolina case, what has been interesting is we had about a 6 or 7 year period before Roy Williams came where there was huge divisions, huge anger between different segments of the fan base. precisely because there was not that Dean Smith figure to rally around. So lots of conflicting ideas got played out every day on the message board.
Mm-hmm. Warren St. John?
I should say I went to, and I describe this in my book, I go to the Bear Bryant namesake reunion at the Bear Bryant Museum in Tuscaloosa, and this is an annual gathering before a game of people named after Bear Bryant, and 600 people showed up. And these are just people who've registered. So presumably there are a lot of other people out there who have no idea why their name is Bear, because their parents never leveled with them.
Well, they gave him the name Bear, well, not even his given
name. There's Bear, Bryant, Paul. Yeah. There are all sorts of iterations. Yeah. But I agree with what Thad said. I think that's exactly it. And if you have a charismatic figure, it helps to be a little enigmatic as well, because that makes it easier for people to project all of their hopes and aspirations onto you. And then, of course, the final and most important fact really is, do you win? And people tend to gravitate towards other people who win and like to associate with them and get that reflected glory.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Arnie Schechter?
Well, I agree with that, although I don't think there will ever be a lot of children named Krzyzewski among the Duke community. But
they might take four letters, for a name.
I do think the longevity of those coaches is a huge factor. I think you don't get that if you're changing coaches every couple of years. Mm-hmm. There was a wonderful Jim Valvano story that he told about a college football coach who was at the banquet, and his team had gone 10-1, won their bowl game, and the head of the boosters the head of the boosters had talked about how much they all love this coach, and the coach got up there and he said, well, you love me, would you love me if I'd gone 1-10? And the head of the boosters says, he says, yeah, coach, we'd love you and we'd miss you too.
Right. Now, how has ESPN changed things? Because Warren St. John, you write in your book that there was that time you were in college and you made a long-distance phone call back to your parents in Alabama and listened for 3 hours to the Alabama-Auburn game?
That's correct. I think Auburn was on probation that year, so it couldn't be televised. So I had to listen by – well, I say in my book I was actually stationed in New Zealand by the New York Times, my employer, to cover the America's Cup for about 4 months. And unfortunately, it was during football season. And it turns out these days it's a lot easier to listen to a football game from New Zealand online than it was back in those days to listen by telephone. And I think ESPN has certainly contributed, I think, to contributed to the intensity of fandom, because when you can watch all the time, when you have these constantly accessible outlets, then that gives the predisposed fan all sorts of chances to immerse themselves. And I think reflexively many of them do this, and online communities, I'd say exactly the same. They're 24/7. You tune into a conversation whenever you want to, and I think that speaks to the kind of incredible power that sports has over the psychology of so many people.
And finally, in the last 10 seconds, can you answer the question that you laid out for yourself? Why do I care?
Well, I chip away at it, and it literally takes a book. So I don't have a simple explanation like 7 or something. I wish I did. But I do really think the roots lie in evolutionary psychology. I think there's a very rational explanation for why we're so consumed watching two sides battle it out.
All right. Well, Warren St. John, thank you for being with us, and thanks Arnie Schechter,
thanks
to Thad Williamson as well. Thank you all.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Warren St. John is author of Hammer Jammer, Yellow Hammer, A Journey into the Heart of Fan Mania. He'll be reading from the book tonight at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Melinda Penkava.